Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
O death, rock me asleep, bring me the quiet rest. Let pass my weary, guiltless ghost out of my careful breast. These lines are attributed to Anne Boleyn. She supposedly wrote them in 1536 in the Tower of London as she was awaiting execution at the hands of a French swordsman who had been brought over specially for the purpose by her erstwhile husband, King Henry VIII, whose marital history has inspired another poem, Divorced, Beheaded, Died, Divorced, Beheaded, Survived. And Dominic Sambra with me. Probably the most famous, the most famously disastrous sequence of marriages in English history. I mean,
in English history, in world history.
Probably the whole of history.
Definitely. Yeah, it's an irresistible subject, isn't it? I mean, it's the stuff of soap operas, it's the stuff of costume dramas, it's the stuff of about 1,000 Channel 5 documentaries.
Well, it's amazing. I mean, you know, we're well into the 70s. I think we've done over 70 episodes. It's kind of extraordinary that we haven't really done one before.
Yeah, it's own Herculean self-restraint, I think.
I guess if we were a TV company, we'd have done six on the, already. We would. Actually, the reason why we have delayed it, doing The Six Wives of Henry VIII, obviously there have been many, many great scholars over the years who have written about the reign of Henry VIII. One thinks of Sir Geoffrey Elton, J.G. Scarisbrick, David Starkey. But these scholars have now been joined by a new kid on the block, Dominic Sambrook. Dominic, your book, The Six Wives of Henry VIII.
Tom, I don't like the slightly ironic way in which you
know. No, but to explain, this is written for children.
Yes.
And absolutely fabulous. I read it last night and I'm not in any way just saying that. I hugely enjoyed it. And I guess, so your other book is on the Second World War. Henry VIII and the Second World War, those are the two big topics. But Henry VIII, really, I mean, it's a timeless classic, isn't it?
It is, and actually I was always a bit suspicious of it. I was never a great aficionado of the Tudors or of the Six Wives of Henry VIII. I always slightly bridled at the sort of, the sort of soap opera-y nature of it. But then when I started getting into it, I actually found it irresistible. And it's partly the court politics and the sort of Game of Thrones style kind of bed hopping shenanigans and all that stuff. But the fact is, it happens at an absolute hinge moment of history against the backdrop of these colossal religious changes, which mean that this is, without question, the biggest political and cultural break in England's history.
So it's all snarled up with Anne Boleyn's sex appeal. And
exactly.
Henry's lust. And
so the weird thing is that all these things that it's very easy to dismiss as froth and gossip and the stuff of kind of some Tudor tattler, they really matter. They change the lives of millions of people. And that's what makes it so enduringly fascinating.
Well, I remember the first time I went to the Loire must have been, I don't know, 20 or something, and visiting all these kind of incredible chateaus that had been built by Henry VIII's exact contemporary, François Premier, Francis I of France, who was king of, a much richer, in many ways, much more sophisticated country than England. And I felt quite intimidated looking at these glories to Gallic civilization. But then I thought, but how many wives did Francis I have? Henry VIII is a much, much better character.
Yeah, he is.
I felt a kind of patriotic glow.
Oh, that's good to hear. That's very good to hear. Well, Francis I, I mean, Henry did measure himself against Francis I of France. And he also measured himself against... So there are basically three big kings, aren't there, at this point?
Well, there are two big kings, aren't there?
Well, there are two big kings
and
one kind of
trying
minnow.
To join the club.
That's right. So there's Francis or François, and then there's Charles or Carlos, the fifth of Spain, who... is also the ruler of the Holy Roman Empire, is just unbelievably rich and has this massive dominion. You know, he's got South America and he's, I mean, he is by far the most potent monarch of the day. And poor old Henry, You know, he just rules England and he's desperate. He's absolutely desperate to be taken seriously by these two guys. And he never, and he's changing his wives all the time. And there's just this sort of farcical, comical element to him, as well as the sort of terrifying and more sinister element.
Well, he, I mean, I think he only seems comical if he does seem comical. And of course, he was played by Sid James in the Carry On film. So I guess there is a slight element of the comic. But up close, I mean, he's a very frightening figure. And the fact that he is actually able to go toe-to-toe with the great kings on the continent, I think are a kind of measure of the swagger and the power and the charisma that he does have. And and that even non-English people experience. I mean, he's a very, very intimidating.
But you don't get Henry Wright, I think, unless you say, you emphasise exactly what you just said about his charisma. So when he becomes king, I mean, he's a very impressive person. He plays tennis. He writes music. He writes songs. He speaks.
He's physically impressive, isn't he? I
mean, he's very
good looking. He's very muscular, very large,
handsome. I mean, everybody says he's handsome. He looks like a king, and he actually behaves. He plays the part of a king very well. I mean, that's one thing I think that sometimes people forget is that actually, to people at the time, what strikes them is not, oh, he's a complete monster and he's so fat and all this sort of stuff. What strikes them is he looks and behaves exactly as a king should. And if he is sometimes cruel and capricious, I think to a lot of people in the 16th century, those things were sort of perhaps slightly lamentable, but they were better than being weak and dithery and pious and sort of a bit sanctimonious and waffly, like Henry VI, for example, always praying when he should have been killing people.
Right.
They like a strong ruler.
And the context for Henry's reign is exactly the Wars of the Roses, where Henry VI of Lancaster is so useless that he ends up kind of being deposed twice, basically.
Yes, by one of... Yeah.
And then you've got... Well, actually, you begin your book with Bosworth, don't you?
Yeah, because I think that's really important to understand his context, so that he... First of all, he doesn't know he's early modern rather than late medieval. You know, he at the back of his mind are the Wars of the Roses. And secondly, he doesn't know that the Wars of the Roses are over. So we conventionally say, well, they ended in 1485 when his father, a Tudor, you know, a Welsh adventurer from a little branch of the family, basically is the last man standing after this great Game of Thrones-style bloodbath. But Henry VIII doesn't know that that's all over. I mean, neither of the two Henrys do. For them, they think there could be a revolt at any moment, that the old kind of guard, the old nobility could be plotting against them, which actually, frankly, a lot of the time they are. So there's that sort of insecurity and that fear, and that lies behind this whole business of the son. He has to have an heir, because he knows if I don't have an heir, then basically everything my dad and I have done will be for nothing, and those bastards will get the throne back again. And that's at the back of his mind the whole time. That fear, you know, that people are this stuff about him being paranoid, which you often read. Oh, Henry was paranoid. He was like Stalin or whatever. I mean, he's only paranoid in the sense that he takes it a little bit further than you or I might have done. But frankly, he lives at a time when if you don't kill people first, they probably will kill you.
Although, I mean, fair enough. But if you're marrying him,
well, yes, I suppose
it's definitely a consideration to bear in mind, isn't it? And also, I suppose the other consideration to bear in mind as he gets older is that he gets fatter and fatter and less and less attractive. And he starts to get smelly, pus-ridden ulcers all up his legs,
and
ultimately he ends up so fat, does he not, Dominic?
Yeah,
that he has to have enemas.
He does. The enemas,
which you may conceivably mention in your book.
I know you love this detail about the enemas. Basically, anyone who ever encounters my book thinks this is either the best thing or the least worst thing in it, which is this description of how Henry's doctors would push this grease tube up his bottom, which was then attached to, I think it's kind of a metal tube, and it's attached to a pig's bladder that's filled with honey and milk and herbs and stuff. And they squirt this. I mean, imagine being the person who does the squirting. They squirt this.
this is the kind of top historical analysis that I'm afraid you just don't get with Sir Geoffrey Elton.
I was about to say, is Geoffrey Elton going for this? I mean, maybe he does. I don't know.
No,
it's David Stargie.
Dreary stuff about Parliament.
I'm sure David Stargie goes in for all this.
Yeah,
or Antonia Fraser. But yeah, I mean, it doesn't make him any more even-tempered, I think. And probably for the wives, certainly towards the end of the reign. This is a kind of slightly unpleasant aspect of marital relations.
So the first, Catherine of Aragon.
Yeah.
Who is the aunt of Charles V.
She is.
The emperor, the king of Spain. And she herself is the daughter of Ferdinand and Isabella, who are the kind of the great dual monarchs, Castile and Aragon, who usher Spain into her golden age. So 1492, they capture Granada, which is the last kind of Muslim outpost, complete the Reconquista. They expel the Jews from Spain, and they serve as patrons for Columbus's discovery of the New World.
Yeah, so, exactly.
So they're heavyweights.
Yeah, and that happens when she's seven. I mean, she's born in 1485.
But in that sense, I mean, it's quite a coup for Henry VII, who's, a bit of a parvenu, a usurper, king of a rather marginal kingdom, to bag their youngest daughter, who I think is Ferdinand's favourite.
Yes, that's right. That's actually absolutely right. And I think it is a bit of a coup for him. The English are delighted with the match. So he lines this up for his eldest son, who's called Arthur, who ends up not becoming king because he dies. So Catherine of Aragon is quite a catch. And the reason I think that they both want the marriage is because they're both anti-French. Such a theme of our podcast, actually, Tom. Yes. Loathing of the French. So the French are incredibly powerful, very rich country, ginormous army. They're obviously a rival to the newly united Castile and Aragon. So it makes sense to ally with the country on the other side, the country to the north, which is England. I mean, England is, it doesn't have a great reputation. It is war-torn, rainy, kind of miserable, not colossally rich. But it kind of works as an alliance. And so poor Catherine of Aragon as a teenager is basically shipped off to a country that she's never been to. She doesn't speak the language.
Well, and this kind of amazing advice that she gets from Henry VII's wife, Elizabeth of York, what she should do to get ready for life in England, is that she should learn to drink wine because the water's so horrible and poisonous. Yes. And she should learn to speak French, which seems odd.
That is weird. Because Elizabeth of York says, no one here speaks Spanish, so don't come here with your lisping ways. You know, you're going to have to speak something else, so why don't you learn French? But it doesn't occur to anybody.
English is just such a kind of déclassé language.
Yeah. English.
What's the point in learning it, even if you're going to England?
Yeah, in France, French is the language of romance and chivalry and high culture. So I suppose that makes sense. It is kind of weird that she pitches up without a word of... I mean, she basically doesn't even have a Berlitz phrase book.
It goes very well, doesn't it? She marries Arthur. It's all very glamorous wedding in St. Paul's.
That's all a great... And she's a great hit, actually, with the crowds. I mean, the one thing about Catherine of Aragon that people really get wrong is we always see her, the sort of late period, a bit like as we do with Henry VIII. We see them at the end rather than at the beginning. At the beginning, she's a teenager. She's pretty. She's quite short. She doesn't look especially Spanish. She's got kind of fair reddish hair. People do say she's got a very deep voice and a sort of very heavily accented. But... You know, she's so young, Tom. She's in her mid-teens. She's said goodbye to her parents. I mean, it really is the kind of trajectory of a children's story. The girl separated from her family who goes away to this weird country. And she acquits herself at first brilliantly. You know, she marries Arthur. Off they go to Ludlow Castle in the marches.
Which is kind of Arthurian legend.
Yeah. I mean, she's living, at that point, she is living a fairy tale. She's gone off to
Camelot.
She's very popular. She's gone to a Camelot. The fire burns in the hearth. They're drinking cups of kind of goblets of warmed wine. And then disastrously, after a few months, when they've been very happy, Arthur drops dead of the sweating sickness. And then she has this terrible time. She comes back to London and basically no one really wants anything to do with her. But she can't go back to Spain. The Spanish don't want her back. Henry doesn't want to send her back. He sort of keeps her as a... It's not
let her have any money, does he?
Yeah, she's got no money. She's got exactly, because he's just piling up taxes in his coffers. Yeah. So she actually clearly goes into a very deep depression. Think about it. She's a girl in her late teens and then early 20s. She doesn't speak the language. She has very few friends. Most of her servants who've come with her go back to Spain. She has been cut off from her family. Her husband, her teenage husband, is dead. She spends all her time praying, and she basically starts writing letters. She writes letters to her father, to the Pope, and so on. And they write back. I mean, at one point, the Pope basically writes to her and says, you've got to start eating. Which, so it's clear that she's starving herself.
Yeah.
Or got some kind of eating disorder. And there's people who are really worried about her. And she's sort of sunk in this utter misery for years.
But then her handsome prince, her second handsome prince,
yes,
comes to the rescue.
But that's exactly what happened. So she'd met Henry at the wedding. And he'd been leaping around like a lunatic. Taking his shirt off and dancing inappropriately or whatever. And everyone thought it was very funny. He's the sort of classic younger brother, you know, who kind of... He's the James Holland.
He's literally Prince Harry.
Yes, he is literally Prince Harry, except without the compassion and kindness. So he's early period Prince Harry, yes. I think it's fair to say. Yes. He's this sort of japester. He becomes king, 1509. He's about to turn 18 or so. So he's young, he's very handsome, very accomplished. And he decides straight away, I must have a wife. And as luck would have it, there's a perfect candidate waiting right there in London, his brother's widow. Now, the question is, even at that stage, there's the question about, is it really legit to marry your brother's widow? Because there's a bit of the Bible that says, don't do it. But then there's another bit of the Bible that says, you really ought to marry your brother's widow.
Yeah.
So they get a dispensation from the Pope. The Pope basically says, it's absolutely fine, go for it. They get married, and Catherine is living the life of Riley. You know, she's emerged from her depression. She's deeply in love with her husband. He seems deeply in love with her. They're very happy. They're having tournaments. They're having these ridiculous masks where he dresses up as kind of Robin Hood or something, comes in with his mates, it bursts into a bedchamber. I mean, you can just picture the scene.
Must be bloody good bloke.
Yeah. We had a really great laugh. We all dressed up as the mayor.
Yeah, okay. So
I mean, you can absolutely... This is why like Damien Lewis was perfect as Henry VIII, because you can absolutely see all these kind of old Herovians or something. Prince Harry is completely the model. They're bursting in. They're all dressed up as the merry men in kind of coloured hoods or something. Yeah. And then the Catherine and the girls say, oh, gosh, I didn't recognise you. Come for a kiss and all this. I mean, they think it's their...
Yeah.
They think this is the height of...
And also, she, when Henry goes off to attack the French, which he's always doing... She helps to guard the northern frontier against the Weasel Scot.
She does. The Scots attack us,
and the Battle of Flodden disastrous defeat for the Scots. So she's doing well. But of course, there's one drawback. She gives Henry a daughter, Mary.
Yeah.
But no son. And as you said, this is a catastrophic failure.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's a failure. I mean, it's an incredibly harsh. That's exactly how.
But that's how it's seen.
That's how it's perceived. You're right. You're dead right. That is how it's judged. It's very harsh.
And of course, the failure is seen as hers rather than Henry's.
Exactly. They do have a son, Henry, but he dies very young, only after, I think, barely.
Well, actually, Dominic, having said that the failure is hers, of course, actually, Henry does come to think the failure might be his as well, doesn't he? Because he comes to see it as being the judgment of God.
He does. And what's clear is that you get to the 1520s, everything seems to be fine. Henry has been king for more than 10 years. He's secure. He's very handsome. Everybody's very impressed with him. You know, he cuts a generally very impressive, if slightly scary, figure. But what clearly happens by the 1520s is she's a bit older than he is. So there's partly that classic kind of psychological thing of the husband with the older wife, and he's... You know, there's an element of a sort of, I don't know, would you call it a midlife crisis? He kind of fancies a younger model. But also the son thing is clearly, she has got used to it, whereas it is weighing on his mind.
Yeah. Okay. So the younger model.
Anne Boleyn.
Probably the most famous of Henry's wives, I would say.
Yeah, I think so.
So Anne Boleyn.
And seen as the most romantic, weirdly, in my mind.
And she didn't need to be told to learn French because she'd spent most of her life in France. She's the daughter of one of Henry's most trusted diplomats,
and Sir Thomas Boleyn.
And she is kind of lady in waiting to the Queen of France, and she comes back to England, and she's fashionable in the way that someone who spent lots of time in France is. She's not, I mean, she's not a sensational beauty, is she?
No, she's not. I mean, that's one of the things that people...
She has a sixth finger.
Is that well, I'm not sure. I think the sixth finger is there's a lot of details about
Anne
Boleyn.
And the third nipple is definitely not true.
That's Scaramanga from The Man with the Golden Gum.
No, no, Christopher Lee. I'm not confusing it.
Very rarely.
Christopher Lee.
Yes, people say she has sallow skin and she kind of a very thin face and she's dark and you know, people sort of disapprove of her looks, but people at court say she is very witty and she's clever and she's sharp. Fiery. And she's kind of charming, in, if you like that kind of thing. And she clearly represents to Henry just the complete antithesis of Catherine, who is so dutiful and serious and is turning more and more to God and basically spending a lot of time praying.
Although Anne is also very religious. But inclining towards this kind of radical new understanding of Christianity that will come to be called Protestantism.
That's right. She's read books in France. She's read like French translations of the Bible and things. So she's full of all this stuff. And I think to Henry, all of this is kind of intoxicating.
Kind of slight Meghan quality, perhaps.
Yeah, I think that's
kind
not
of
a bad...
Coming, yeah. You know, coming from another country, bringing a kind of radical, exciting, dramatic new way of understanding things. And
it also really suits Henry, by the way, this new way, because the new way makes him more powerful. Because obviously the Pope is colossally powerful, and the new way basically involves saying, oh, the Pope doesn't really have power over you. You know, she's basically giving him, Anne Boleyn is giving Henry all these pamphlets by William Tyndale and Simon Fish and these kind of Reformation theologians, which conveniently for him say, oh, the Pope has no jurisdiction in your kingdom at all. You can do what you like.
Yeah,
so from Henry's point of view, it's kind of win-win.
Pile in, yes. So he does. He decides he wants to divorce Catherine, and decides he wants to do it because of the biblical injunction against brothers marrying their brothers' wives.
But Tom, that's just not a decision that we should just dismiss lightly. That is a colossal.
Are you saying that I'm downplaying the significance of biblical injunction?
For once,
Heaven forbid.
The shame of it.
Of course. I mean, it's incredibly important.
But it's also the fact that Anne, this is Anne's extraordinary role in history, actually. Kings had had mistresses since time immemorial. Henry had had mistresses, including Anne's sister, Mary. The really remarkable thing is that Anne says, I will not be your mistress. I must be your wife.
So does that mean, and obviously this is not a detail that you went into in your children's book, does that mean that Henry does not sleep with Anne until they marry?
So historians have discussed that. I mean, no one knows. I mean, the truth of what makes the Six Wives so fascinating, I think, for people writing popular history books is there's actually so little that we do know that you can fill in a lot with your own imagination.
Because it's kind of 6 years, isn't it? Six, seven
years.
I mean,
no, I can't remember.
The
somebody
King's
like
Great Matter.
Somebody
goes
like
on a long
David
time.
Starkey or somebody like that says at some point she didn't sleep with him, but she may have satisfied him by other means.
Yes. Yes. Like, a sex act.
Yeah, exactly. Sort of some sort of Bill Clinton style,
Okay, we're going to get
distinction.
This is going to be an adult rated episode, so we should rein back on that. Yes, okay, so of course this then gets dragged into the great mangle that turns out to be the Reformation.
Yeah, which Henry has been against, actually, earlier, because of course he'd written in defence of the seven sacraments
against Luther,
yeah, and he had this, Luther had called him a mad fool with a frothy mouth.
So I think we should do another episode on the Reformation in England.
Of course we should. Of course, multiple episodes.
Thomas Cromwell and so on. So let's keep the focus on the wives.
Yeah, okay.
So basically the problem is that the Pope has just been taken prisoner by the Emperor.
Yeah, Charles V's troops, have stormed Rome.
So the Pope is in no position to allow Henry to divorce the Emperor's aunt.
No, the Emperor would be livid about...
There's a kind of deadlock, and the Pope plays for time, and Henry's getting increasingly frustrated, perhaps in every way. Who knows?
Yeah.
And so, with the help of Thomas Cromwell, as in Wolf Hall, Henry finds a way to cut the Gordian knot, which is basically to repudiate papal supremacy, to declare himself basically in charge of the church in England. And in this way, he's able to marry Anne.
Exactly. And poor old Catherine gets shoved off to a succession of country houses. Basically, again, she, like Anne, as with Anne, the remarkable thing is she doesn't take the easy option either. So the easy option would be to say, fair enough, you know, we shouldn't have got married in the first place. It was against the laws of God. I'm off to a nunnery, you know, where I'll probably live in very, you know, I'll be well looked after and properly treated and stuff. And but she basically says, no, I haven't come all this way and put up with all this
stuff. Thomas Cromwell, whose manoeuvrings basically kind of back her out. I mean, he's terribly impressed by her, isn't he?
Yeah, he says she should have been a man. If she'd been a man, she'd be one of the greatest figures in Christendom. Because basically, she defies him in public at this incredible trial. I mean, no wonder Channel 5 commissioners like this. The trial scene where this aged cardinal, this sort of Italian sort of mafioso has been sent from Rome, Cardinal Campeggio, and he's sitting there with Cardinal Wolsey. And she basically stands up and humiliates Henry in front of the whole, all this audience,
and
all
then the when it becomes obligatory to swear the oath.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, this is what does for Thomas More. He, you know, goes to the block over it. Both Catherine and Mary, her daughter, refused to swear it. So, I mean, there's kind of slight sense of jeopardy there. I mean, obviously, Henry's, you know, he's not going to execute the emperor's.
No, he can't execute her. He can execute other people. But it's so telling. You're dead right that he doesn't. And there's absolutely no question, really. There's no danger of him executing Catherine.
So Catherine gets. She kind of gets retired, doesn't she? She basically kind of wastes away and dies, gets buried in Peterborough Cathedral.
Yeah.
And to this day, flowers are laid by her graves and pomegranates, the symbol of Aragon.
She's very popular with the British, with the English people. Not the British people, the English
and
people.
So she is seen as the queen.
She
and
is,
Anne Boleyn,
really.
For that reason, is not popular. I think that we should take a break at this point.
Sure.
And I think that when we come back, we should look at the rise and fall of Anne Boleyn and then have a canter through the remaining four queens.
Yeah, jolly good. See you after the break.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, welcome back to The Rest is History. We're talking the six wives of Henry VIII. We've only got onto the two first ones, Catherine of Aragon, who died just before the commercial break, and Anne Boleyn, who is now Queen Dominic.
Yeah.
But not popular.
No, people used to sort of mutter. They called her, what do they call her, a kind of naughty strumpet and all this kind of stuff. Yes, a naughty goggle-eyed witch. That's my favourite. My favourite voice of the people quote
the tabloids
about
tabloids getting after her.
Yes, exactly. She's not popular. She's not seen as some.
But her unpopularity wouldn't have mattered if she'd given Henry a son.
Yeah, once
but
again.
She gives him a daughter, Elizabeth.
Yes.
Mary has been kind of cast aside. So Elizabeth is now the heir. But obviously Henry wants a son.
He's got to have a son. He's obsessed with it now.
Anne gets pregnant again. Henry's in a tournament.
Yes.
He has a fall. Briefly, it looks like he's dead.
Yeah.
So, but he comes around, but he sustained a serious sporting injury. I know myself how demoralising sporting injuries can be. So a bit of sympathy for him there. But Anne is so upset by this that basically she miscarries.
Exactly. That's exactly what happens just after the tournament accident.
Okay, and so what happens then?
Well, then it's a slightly confusing and murky series of events where basically what really happens is Anne and Henry have always had a very tempestuous relationship, completely unlike his relationship with Catherine of Aragon. So there's been a lot of quarrelling. And he's sometimes said to her, you know, I can kind of drop you as quickly as I picked you up, because she's spiky and she's acerbic and she's very quick with the kind of put downs and she's hot tempered herself. So
war, that's all you ever think of, Henry Tudor.
Very good. So, yes, she's there's a lot of bickering. And in the midst of all this, she falls out with his chief minister, Thomas Cromwell. And it's partly because Cromwell really wants an alliance. Think of him as a kind of prime minister. He really wants an alliance with Charles V, with the empire against the French. But basically, Anne is an obstacle to that because the emperor will never do a deal as long as he has to recognize Anne as the queen. Anne is also a threat to Cromwell's sort of spending plans and his ambitions. He wants to be the man, and she basically thinks she should be in charge.
Because Henry is basically inventing Whitehall Palace at this point, isn't he?
He's
a massive development, luxury development, spending money that he doesn't really have.
That's exactly
Cromwell
it,
is about to serve it up to him by dissolving the monasteries.
So there's a sort of internal power struggle, and I think Cromwell effectively orchestrates the whole thing. He basically realises that if he can play on Henry's fear and the fact that he's always falling out with Anne, and basically say, do you know what, Anne is plotting against you, she's been betraying you with all these blokes, including her own brother, a court musician, some of your own friends, all of this. And Henry, and the amazing thing is that Henry just swallows it. I mean, that's a sign maybe of his deep insecurity, that when Cromwell tells him this stuff, there's no question of, you know, he'll have a little meeting with Anne to talk through their marital troubles, or he just says, fine, you know, killer. And I think that's the point at which the story crosses over from, frankly, the usual, you know, because a lot of this stuff before that is, it's not that unprecedented. But I think the point at which Henry says, fine, she's got to go, we'll kill her, that is the point where this becomes a really extraordinary story.
Yeah. Okay. So Anne goes to the tower, and then she goes to the block.
Yeah.
And Henry, meanwhile, he's got a new crush.
Yes.
Who is a Wiltshire girl.
Yes, so probably your favourite wife,
yeah, absolutely,
in that case.
Yes. So Jane Seymour, who grows up in Wolf Hall, as in the novel. And she's very much a Wiltshire girl, so she loves ponies.
Yeah.
She's got a dog.
Dogs. Dog. Yeah. Basically, do you know what, we know nothing at all about? No one knows anything about Jane Seymour.
No,
so the stuff about dogs, I find this hilarious, actually, the Six Wives of Henry VIII historiography. There'll be a source that basically says once she was in the same room as a dog. And then if you trace that through the books, by the time you get to sort of books published in the 1990s, they're saying the most famous dog lover in English history invented dogs. Just because people are desperate to flesh out these kind of bodice-ripping kind of histories of the Tudors.
She's a Wiltshire girl who loves ponies and loves dogs. No one's going to change my view on that. And she's sweet, kind, marries Henry, gives him a son, Edward VI,
but dies. Very unlucky. I mean, Henry's a very unlucky. He's gone for Jane Seymour, and actually that would probably worked out completely fine.
Yeah.
She clearly knows exactly what's expected of her, which is basically to be little more than a sort of pretty accessory. There's no reason to believe they would have fallen out. It would have all been fine. It's just incredibly bad luck that she dies just after giving birth to Edward VI.
Okay, and now we come to my favourite queen.
Everyone's favourite queen, surely.
Everyone's favourite queen. Who you, in your book, she was bland, she was boring, she was German.
well, those things are all true, aren't they?
She's apologies to her. She's not bland.
Well,
she's not boring.
She's seen as bland by Henry.
She is German. So we're talking Anne of Cleves.
Anne of Cleves.
Who is Thomas Cromwell trying to find, who wants... So the problem is, Henry, by this point, is...
Everybody,
he's burnt his bridges with Catholic Europe. And so, essentially, Thomas Cromwell, a devout Protestant, wants to find him a Protestant bride.
Yeah.
Anne of Cleves comes... I mean, she actually, her father's not Protestant.
No, but they're very close to them. They've played a kind of a cunning middle game.
Yeah.
They're very close to the sort of Protestant league of German states.
And so famously,
they
send Holbein, the great painter, over to paint her. Comes back. Henry looks there, goes, yeah, that's very nice.
Yes.
She comes over.
And
everyone thinks she's very pretty. You know,
this is the thing. The Flanders Mare stuff, people call her the Flanders Mare, is totally untrue. She comes over and everybody says she's absolutely fine. She's not a stunner. She's not a kind of Victoria's Secret model in waiting. But she is absolutely, utterly inoffensive and fine. The problem is Henry... The one thing that... So we had some questions and people said about Henry being a sex addict. He absolutely wasn't a sex addict. What Henry was a child, almost childish romantic. He was sort of utterly raised on all this Arthurian romance stuff. He wants a Guinevere. He wants somebody that he can feel swept up with. So he does this disastrous, yet absolutely laughable introduction to her when she's come to England and he and his mates, they go back to the old Prince Harry tactic.
Yeah, well, it is that kind of woof woof thing.
They literally dress up as Robin Hood and the Merry Men, and they pitch up in, I think, Rochester, isn't it? It's in Rochester at the Bishop's Palace in multicolored hoods. They burst into her room and she's sitting there with
no idea what's going on.
And they're watching bear baiting, and she's looking out the window. So these clowns burst in these hoods, and she just kind of looks at them and mutters in German and won't even look them in the eye. And is embarrassed by it. And Henry never, ever forgives her for that. I mean, that moment, he basically says, she's no good. I don't like her. I've taken against her.
Cromwell says, I can't, you know, you've got to go ahead with it. So he goes ahead with it.
They postpone it by a day of, or something.
Goes to bed with her. The next morning he says, out of the question. Impossible.
He goes to see the doctors. This is the hilarious thing. He goes to see his doctors and he says, what should we do? I can't do anything. And they say, there's not much we can really do about this. You're not going to get a son unless...
so not good enough. She has to go, brings down Cromwell, who goes to the block.
Yeah, I mean, Cromwell
pays.
So
all these kind of great figures of the Tudor court who basically every time the wheel turns and another wife goes, they go as well.
Yes.
So Cromwell goes. But the thing I like about Anne of Cleves is that she plays her hand well.
Very well. Because he comes with a deal, doesn't he?
So essentially, she stays in England. She doesn't have to go back kind of humiliated and broken to her father. She stays in England. She gets she kind of gets two palaces and loads of properties. So Dominic, the Sussex Archaeological Society, have you come across this?
I'm aware you're very enthusiastic.
Well, it's a wonderful organisation. It's Britain's oldest county archaeological society, 175 years this year. Basically most of its properties at some point were owned by Anne of Cleves.
Were they?
So all over Sussex and actually all over southeast England, you come across some beautiful Tudor property and the guidebook will say it was owned by Anne of Cleves.
Well, she was given the equivalent of tens and tens of millions of pounds. But the weird thing is she then stays in England all this time, but then she runs out of money. So basically, having been a good girl, she clearly just sort of went mad.
Went wild, didn't she?
And just spent all this money on something. Yeah. I don't know what. Sort of later on, she's constantly complaining that everything in England is too expensive.
Yeah.
Just that classic thing of
I love her.
A
really
European
love her.
Person who's moved to England, but basically just whinges the whole time about the weather, everything's too expensive.
Great. She's really
the English
great.
Don't pay her enough respect. even when she dies much later on, she's the longest lived of all the wives. When she dies, there's a heat wave, and so the government says to people, don't go to Anne of Cleves' funeral. So
she
nobody,
does have a state funeral, doesn't she?
So nobody goes. Because it's too hot. So I mean,
I would have gone. She's the queen of my heart. But meanwhile, talking of good girls and bad girls.
Yeah.
Henry's fixed his eye on a young teenager called Catherine Howard.
Yeah. So this is a kind
of behaved quite badly.
This is a slightly tragic story, isn't it? He marries Catherine Howard. There's a big age gap at this stage, and this is the point at which he has definitively become a whale. So yeah. He's very, very fat. And he just takes a fancy to her. And at this point, he's in a ridiculous kind of midlife crisis stage.
Yeah, I mean, she is basically the marital equivalent of buying a bright red sports car.
Absolutely, she is. And she's sort of pushed in front of him by the Howard family. They notice him looking at her, and they push her in front, and they basically coach her. Oh, well, you can woo the king this way, you know, always laugh at his jokes, always admire his ulcer. Whatever.
Hot.
And she marries him. And everything is fine for a while. And he dotes upon, he gets up early and goes hunting to try and lose a bit of weight and sort of try to impress her. But basically, he then discovers, because the Archbishop of Canterbury, Cranmer, gives him a note that says, I've got very bad news about your wife. She's been carrying on with men like a music teacher and stuff before she married you, which Henry can kind of forgive. But then it turns out that she's been carrying on with other men while they were married.
Thomas Culpepper.
A man called Thomas Culpepper, who's a very bad man indeed. He's basically a rapist. And Thomas Culpepper is one of Henry's sort of Prince Harry style. He's Guy Pelly. He's a bougie's habitué who
bloody loves skiing.
Yeah, exactly. He's been carrying on with Catherine Howard. And again, you know, Henry, again, because he can, because she's not royal, she's not from a foreign, you know, dynastic house or something, he just basically, he's humiliated. And there's these dreadful scenes in front of his council where he's sobbing like a child.
Yeah.
You lied to me. You told me she was, I'm so unhappy.
And
she has to go. She gets
And it happens at Hampton Court, doesn't it? Because you've already sneered at this story that Catherine Howard's ghost still haunts Hampton Court.
Yeah, because she's executed at the Tower of London.
Yeah, but she gets arrested at Hampton Court. And she's trying to get to Henry in his chapel, and her screams to this day can be heard echoing around the palace.
This is another good example, actually. This is another brilliant example of the inflation of Tudor historiography.
Oh, yeah, right.
Come
all Elton on me.
She's, there's a story, the one source that describes this says that the dancing instructors arrive at her rooms and are sent away by the guards, who say there's no more time to dance, basically she's been arrested. But that's become inflated in all the sort of various popular biographies of Catherine Howard, that she was dancing one day when the guards burst in and drag her by her hair through the door or something. But she dies. It's actually a dreadful, dreadful scene. You can imagine it. She's so young. She's a teenager. She's shaking. You know, they have to help her up to the scaffold, the guards, because she's shaking so much. And she's so tearful.
She wanted to see the block before she died, didn't she?
Yes, she did. And she
horrible kind of detail.
She's clearly utterly traumatized.
Yeah.
So that's actually, although I think David Starkey possibly describes her as a sort of, in his account, she's a sort of strumpet and all this stuff. I mean, she's just a teenager. You know, it's a very, very harsh.
Who's posted something unwise on TikTok?
Exactly. Who's been cancelled? Well,
okay. Literally
been cancelled.
and then the very last one. The one who survives, Catherine Parr.
Yes, often regarded as a bit boring, I think greatly unfairly. She's a very impressive person. She's married twice. She's made two very good marriages. Once to a weedy but rich fellow who dies. Once to a rich, older man called Lord Latimer, a widower, who's very kind to her and leaves her money and houses and stuff. She really wants to marry somebody else at this point, but Henry basically has his eye on her. He wants an old widow. Not old, I mean, she's not old, but he wants somebody a bit more experienced. He's not going down the teenage route again. And she's very Protestant. I think that's one reason why she does it, is that she thinks, I will be able to advance the cause of the true religion. And obviously there are, you know, although we don't have terrific sources for this, you can well imagine that there are people at court who are Protestants who sort of encourage her, say, you know, you should do this.
And so she survives.
And she survives. She's very clever, because there's a couple of points at which it looks like Henry might get rid of her as well for arguing with him about religion. But she's very quick. She always goes into his room and she says, oh, I only talk to you about religion to take your mind off your leg. I just love having instruction from you. Please mansplain to me a bit more about indulgences and purgatory. And Henry loves all this. You know, he has no sense of irony, clearly, so he just sucks all this up.
And then after Henry dies, she marries her true love, doesn't she?
Yeah, Thomas Seymour. And then there's some very strange...
Who then tries to kind of rape Elizabeth.
Very strange business. Yeah, so he's tickling Elizabeth, and then one day, and she joins in. She holds Elizabeth down and they both tickle her. But then later on, one morning, she gets up and she finds him trying to kiss Elizabeth. So Elizabeth, poor Elizabeth, has to go.
And then she dies a couple of years after. Yeah. Right. So those are the six wives. Now, I was talking about this yesterday to my daughter, Eliza, and her friend, Anna, who are in the midst of watching Love Island. I imagine you're a big Love Island fan.
Massive Love Island fan. Yeah.
So they got to wondering... Which of them would win Love Island?
Yeah.
So shall I tell you the...
So explain to me, I'm lying when I say I'm a Love Island fan. And Love Island, do you get voted off by the public? Or do you have
I think so. I've only seen it occasionally. But I think you go in, the idea is that you go into the... the Casa Amor.
Is that what it's called?
Yes. And basically you... You know, you have to get off with someone,
right?
And you have to stay a couple, and all the other ones are trying to break you up, and that kind of thing. So it is quite Tudor court.
Yeah, very Tudor court.
But obviously, the part of it is that you then come out, and it's about your media profile. So it's not just about doing well within the show. It's also about whether you come out and you're an influencer, and how you're remembered.
Like you're an influencer, Tom.
Like I'm an influencer. So yeah, so I feel a lot of kind of fellow feeling. So they thought the best... Shall I do it in ascending order?
Do.
Best contestant on Love Island. So they dissed Catherine Parr. That's mad. So Anna, who is actually Spanish, so you can guess who's sympathy she said she was a devout Protestant who spends a lot of time reading. And she was also voted the least likely to sport fake tan.
I think Catherine Parr has been married twice before. I mean, she knows her way around men. I think she's got a track record. I think she would. I don't think she'd win, but I think she'd acquit herself.
Do you think she'd wear?
And also the fact that she has this fancy. Yeah, I do, because the fact that she has the fancy for this Thomas Seymour, and Thomas Seymour is a very rakish, roguish sort of fellow. He would be an excellent Love Island contestant. And I think the fact that she has this mad obsession with him suggests to me there's more to Catherine Parr.
You can't have too mad an obsession, because if needs be, you might have to... That was Eliza and Anna's verdict.
I think they're being misled by her Protestantism with that.
they really thought Protestantism and Love Island didn't go together. Clearly. I mean, we to argue. Number five is Jane Seymour, just because they said she was very boring.
Yeah,
she'd just go around being nice to people.
People do say this, but that's only... I think people just say that she's boring because they don't... We know so little about her. I mean, she might have been...
Well, yeah, but that's no good on Love Island. You don't know anything about her. You're not going to...
I suppose so. She'd blame the editing, wouldn't she? She'd blame the...
Yes.
she'd say they cut out all my best bits.
But I think that's fair enough. So, and then number five is Anne of Cleves.
Right.
Which I was surprised she got that. But the reason for that is that they said she was quite... She leveraged it quite well.
So, yeah.
You know, contestants come out and they get kind of, you know, a column in the Sun or whatever. And sponsorship deal or whatever. And so basically, that's what she does.
I suppose you're saying she's a sort of Katie Price figure. She'd constantly be in Hello Magazine or yes. Yeah.
Yes.
Did you say that's right, Grandad?
I did.
Because of my knowledge of Katie Price. Move on.
Honestly. Number three, Catherine of Aragon.
Number three.
Yeah.
But I mean, she only ever... Well, go on.
So a lot of sympathy.
Yeah.
A lot of sympathy for her. She'd be a voter's favourite. So people would feel sorry for her.
Yeah.
There's all the drama with the two brothers. That would play well, apparently, on Love Island.
I suppose.
According to Eliza, very Amy and Curtis. I have no idea what that means.
What does that
mean? Maybe,
yeah,
maybe
I don't know what that means either.
But probably lots of listeners, I guess.
I don't see her. Anyway. I can't even see her going on Love Island. Maybe she was sent by Ferdinand and Isabella.
Dominic, none of them would go on Love Island. That's a ridiculous thing to say.
That's a bit like when my dad went to see The Lord of the Rings when it came out of the cinema. And the first film, and I said to him afterwards, how did she get on with it? He said, I thought it was good, but I just thought it was implausible. It's like, which bit did you find implausible? The ring? The backstory with the dragon? Gollum?
Right. Well,
the giant eye floating
equally,
in the sky.
Equally, it's implausible that dead Tudor queens would appear on Love Island. But okay, just for the sake, run with me. Run with me.
I think Catherine of Aragon would get a lot of audience sympathy.
Yeah. So she's an audience favourite.
But I don't see her... I just can't see her copping off with people kind of willy-nilly, as it were.
Okay, so on that for that reason, that's why ahead of her...
Yeah.
Who do you think it is, Anne Boleyn or Catherine Howard?
I think it's Anne Boleyn.
No, it's Catherine Howard. Catherine Howard. So she would be... They said she would be used by the producers. So she would be massively exploited by the producers.
She'd be the one on the front page of The Sun, wouldn't she?
Yeah. So the producers would kind of edit the footage to make it look like she was, you know, a cheat... kind of love rat,
yeah,
whatever.
They would.
And also they would feed her lines to say, and she'd probably be naive enough to say them.
She would, yeah,
but that
right.
would obviously make her a great contestant.
She would be very good. But you think the public would... You see, that I think it would. She would possibly bring out, you're right in that she would probably bring out the more censorious and the sort of more vicious side of the British public, who would turn on her, wouldn't they?
Yeah, and so I think that's why she's at number two, behind Anne Boleyn. So comments on Anne Boleyn,
yeah,
feisty and vocal, a fan favourite. I mean, that's indisputable. I think Anne Boleyn is the fan favourite. I think she is the wife that people are most fascinated
but not
by.
A fan favourite at the time, though, Tom.
No, but now. It's all about capturing the zeitgeist. So that's apparently the key to winning Love Island.
Right.
It's about capturing the zeitgeist. And I
Which
guess
she certainly
does
did
that.
With her Protestantism.
She's iconic.
Yeah, but not
and
then.
She's even more than Anne of Cleves, she is the most likely to have been a successful influencer.
Well, she was a very successful influencer, as we know. I mean, you could argue she's one of the most successful influencers in English history. I think that her unpopularity, the naughty goggle-eyed witch issue, would cost her with the audience. You see, I think she's unpopular with the audience.
I think that we should watch Love Island. And we should do a historical couples Love Island episode.
Historical couples.
Maybe wait for the next season.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt,
Antony and Cleopatra, and all the famous ones.
Let's not do the fellow who got married in the bunker. I think that would be inappropriate.
that would indeed be inappropriate. And I think on that note. We've done Henry VIII. It wouldn't be an episode of Henry VIII without a mention of Hitler. So I think we should end at that point. Thank you for your forbearance, everyone, in listening to...
This took a very unexpected turn.
Yes, it did. But I think quite a fun one. Because I think part of the fascination of the wives, of the six wives of Henry VIII, is that they are... Even people who care nothing about history know about them.
They do. Well, they're archetypes, aren't they? The good girl, the strumpet, the sort of long suffering wife. They're sort of almost slightly comic archetypes, which is
the wife who owns properties owned by the Sussex Archaeological Society.
Exactly,
the classic archetype.
The German,
the German. Yes. Okay. Right. So thanks very much for listening. Our next episode coming out on Thursday is the East India Company with Willie Dalrymple. So hope you enjoy that. Hope you've enjoyed this. We will be back soon. Thanks a lot. Bye bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.